Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. And boy oh boy, do we have a show for you today. Adam and I will be talking through the week's news in just a moment. The doxing and sanctions against the Medibank hacker. We're going to talk about Microsoft getting clown card again by Russians. There is just so much good stuff to talk about this week. And then we're actually going to be joined by a feature guest this week, Rob Silvers. He is the Undersecretary of Policy at DHS and the Chair of the Cyber Safety Review Board. And he's popping in to set the record straight on a few things. There was a Senate hearing into the CSRB last week. And, you know, some of the testimony was a bit unkind in a few ways and actually a little bit off base. So Rob's going to be along a little bit later on to talk about why the board relies on industry figures to participate in it, which was one of the areas where CSIB got a bit criticised last week. And they're also going to talk about how they handle conflicts of interest, because there is a very robust process there. And he's also going to talk a bit about what's going to change for the CSIB once a new bill passes that will give it subpoena powers, right? So that is coming up soon. This week's sponsor interview is with Travis McPeak of Resourcely. And we're talking to Travis about how dashboard products that do things like detect cloud misconfigurations are great, but they don't actually help you fix problems. So Travis thinks we need to focus more on laying down what he calls paved roads for developers instead of trying to mitigate issues after they're in production. You know, and trying to mitigate them by plumbing Wiz through to Jira. You know, you get a ticket and you get a ticket and everyone gets a ticket. Woo! That's coming up later. But first up, let's get into the week's news now with Adam Boileau. Adam, hello.
Oh, hello there, Pat.
And mate, we have seen a disclosure to the SEC by Microsoft and an announcement from Microsoft, which is just a "you what, mate?" kind of incident disclosure. This one is so weird. Can you start by telling us what actually happened here?
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, Microsoft. So some Russian military hackers were nosing around Microsoft presence on the internet, managed to just like straight up password brute force or guess or reuse a password single factor into some like old test system.
A test tenant. Yeah, they password sprayed their way into a test tenant. I mean, that's no big deal because it's a test tenant, right?
Yeah, well, what possible access could it have? Turns out in Microsoft world, their test tenant somehow, by mechanisms we haven't really understood yet, had access to all of their corporate email, or at least a subset of their corporate email. It's a little unclear how, but the net result was that this particular group, Midnight Blizzard or Nobelium, they were rummaging around in the email spools of senior, you know, cybersecurity people and legal people, trying to find out what they knew about Midnight Blizzard, the hacking crew in question. And Microsoft dropped this disclosure on like late on a Friday afternoon with not much detail, which left a lot of us, as you say, going, "Excuse me, you what, mate?
You what, mate?" Like, that was just come again?
Yeah.
And I love it. I think they said something about like how production systems weren't impacted. It's like, hang on, man. If you got Russians rolling through like very sensitive mail spools with authed access, I mean, sure, okay, that's not a production system breach, but those are kind of production accounts, wouldn't you think?
I'm sure Microsoft's legal people feel that their email is a production system. But yeah, the idea that an old test account, single factor on the internet, bad password could lead to Microsoft legal's emails, like that's not a situation that should be happening. And, you know, Microsoft has spent quite a bit of time lately talking about, you know, they launched their new, Secure Future Initiative.
Yeah, but that's only a couple of months old. Like, we can't say the initiative has failed, right, because of this. Like, but, I had to read this twice. Were you the same? When they published this, read it and you're like, hang on.
Maybe there's some wrinkle in here. Maybe there's some nuance. Maybe there was some stunt hacking in here we missed, you know. And the Chinese clearly had to work hard there and pull off some epic stunt hacks.
Yeah.
The Russians did not.
They password sprayed into an over-provisioned account abandoned in a test tenant. Like, listen to this, though. The language is hilarious because I reckon it's my feeling that this account that they got by password spraying had a lot of privilege, right? So they only used it on certain accounts. But listen to the wording here from Microsoft. The threat actor used a password spray attack to compromise a legacy non-production test tenant account and gain a foothold. And here's the important part. and then used the account's permissions to access a very small percentage of Microsoft corporate email accounts. Now, you would notice they didn't tell us what percentage of Microsoft corporate accounts that account had access to, just that it was only used to access a very small percentage of them. So I'm wondering if this gave them access to pretty much everything.
I mean, you know, having full access to read people's emails is pretty privileged. And, you know, clearly to a bunch of people.
Like that's not that's not just like a duplicated user privilege, right? Like this is, you know, how could that only give them access to like senior cybersecurity and legal? Like, no. This thing feels like it could have been an account that was provisioned in such a way that gave them access to Microsoft Corp email boxes, like all of them at a minimum. Yes. And possibly more.
Possibly more. Like, I don't know what the inside of Microsoft Net looks like. I assume there is not one domain admin that just gives you everything inside Microsoft.
Well, to reassure you on that, I'm sure Microsoft have no idea what their internal network looks like either. So I don't think you're alone on that. Don't feel bad, Adam. Don't feel bad.
But, I mean, come on, Microsoft. Like, this is how you get CSR beat, right? This is how you end up, you know, getting spanked and having governments looking at you askew and people asking questions. Because, you know, we expect Microsoft customers to do better than this, which means we have to expect Microsoft to do better than this.
Yeah. Look, I think this just is a product of scale, right? Like, it really is a product of scale when you're not paying very close attention from the top down to security to stop stuff like this from happening. Because, you know, at this point, Microsoft has just grown so quickly. You know, Saatchi has done an amazing job of turning Microsoft into just, because it was its influence was on the wane, you know what I mean? Sort of felt like Microsoft's sun was setting, and then in comes Saatchi and just turns them into a beast again. And you know, the emphasis was on growth. It wasn't on security and safety. Yeah.
All of the cloud business and Azure, and like so much has happened there that you can certainly understand a test tenant in Azure somewhere, you know, having a whole bunch of access because they are, you know, very much building that as they are flying it.
Yes.
And at least, you know, to their credit. So this, apparently the breach happened sometime in November. They spotted it in on January the 12th, and they were disclosing it to the SEC on January the 19th. So
yeah,
5 days to turn around an investigation, like that's pretty good, actually.
I mean, I've heard from one CISO pal who's like, I don't know that this is material. I don't know that they needed to disclose this to the SEC, but I guess they're just erring on the side of caution, which we're going to see a lot of companies doing that this year now that these new SEC disclosure rules are in place.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing, right? I mean, much better that it doesn't get covered up. I would much rather know that there were Russians inside Microsoft's mail spools, you know, even if we don't know the specifics of how, I would like to know, and I'm sure many of the customers and shareholders would also like to know.
Yeah. Now, look, moving on to the other big story of the week, and this one is just, I love this. I want to inject this story into my veins. The Australian government has identified, doxed, and sanctioned the individual responsible for the hack of the Medibank private health insurer here in Australia. This happened in, I think it was October 2022, so about 15 months ago. Yeah, they found him. ASD and AFP went after the guy. They found him. They've identified him. They've published his name, his location, his handles. And also, I love this, they published the trophy shot from the guy's webcam just to let him know. Just to let him know that his box got shelled. Here are some comments from Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong announcing the sanctions.
This morning I can announce that Australia has used cyber sanctions powers for the very first time on a Russian individual for his role in the breach of the Medibank private network. I can confirm that thanks to the hard work of the Australian Signals Directorate and the AFP, we have linked Russian citizen and cyber criminal Alexander Ermakov to the attack. Richard will speak more about the substantial efforts which have gone towards this, and can I thank the officials for their work on it. I also want to acknowledge Tim Watts, the Assistant Foreign Minister, who has worked so hard on this attribution and on these sanctions. The sanctions imposed are targeted financial sanctions and a travel ban. This will mean it is a criminal offence punishable with up to 10 years imprisonment to provide assets to Ermakov or to use or deal with his assets, including through cryptocurrency wallets or ransomware payments. It sends a clear message that there are costs and consequences for targeting Australia and for targeting Australians.
Say cheese, motherfucker!
Exactly.
But look, the United States and the UK have also followed suit and also sanctioned this guy. And I just think this is great. And I've seen a few people poo-pooing the sanctions. Oh, well, what's that going to do? Blah, 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 blah. But I think the sanctions component is actually less important than the doxing component, because this guy's life just got a lot more complicated. He's probably going to have to pay some bribes to stay out of trouble. Every single criminal in Russia now knows that he is a vulnerable 33-year-old with an absolute ton of Bitcoin. So, you know, this is not a happy time for him. And he's probably, like, right down in the well of the paranoia vortex right now, like tearing apart every electronic device in his possession, trying to look for ASD shells that have long been removed. So sucks to be you, dude. But what's your feeling on all of this?
I mean, I think given how difficult it is to get people out of Russia to face any kind of justice, right, there weren't a whole deal of great options. And, you know, on the one hand, doxing someone as a nation state as a way of punishing, right? I mean, there are some concerns around that. I mean, there's the, you know, we have a judicial system, we have a system that's meant to deal out justice. And
oh, but an arrest warrant does the same thing. Come on.
Yeah. So, I mean, the point is, like, there are other mechanisms that we would prefer in the ideal world to use rather than just doxing someone in the foreign country. But we don't have any of those options. And this is, honestly, it's just really nice to see. Right.
But even if we did have that option, we would still be doxing them by nature of arresting them or putting out an arrest warrant. Right. So I don't know that there are any concerns about that. I do think, I mean, don't forget, this is the guy who published a list of women who had claimed pregnancy terminations on their health insurance in Australia.
Yes.
Pulled that out and published it. Like he is like a scumbag, right? Yes, like a total scumbag.
I agree.
So he got the special treatment. He got the special. They're not going to do this for the guy who enumerated Optus data. Like, yes. No, they won't. This guy gets the full treatment.
The special treatment. Yes.
Yeah. But I wonder if this is enough to disincentivize other people in Russia from doing the same sort of thing in Australia. And I would have to fall on the side of thinking it would dissuade some people. I think when you see that you actually get a special response like this, I think some people would decide it's not worth it. Not all of them, because these people aren't the clearest thinkers or the most logical thinkers, but I think it could actually make a difference.
Yeah, and especially, like, you have a plethora of target options as a cybercrim, right? And even if you are specializing in, you know, English-speaking Western first world countries, you've still got other options. Like, New Zealand is very like Australia. You could hit us instead of the Australians. And that, you know, it doesn't take much to run faster than the next guy to get away from the bear, you know? And the Australian government and the, you know, deploying the SIGINT agency to go impose some cost on people. Like, I think there probably are a lot of other governments looking at Australia's response here and going, actually, yeah, maybe this could work for us too. Maybe there is some option here to be able to go and impose cost in a way that, you know, gets around the lack of good law enforcement, normal criminal process. And so in that respect, like, you know, we're all about releasing the hounds around here. And I think Australia has released some hounds, and those hounds have caught their quarry, and we have the trophy picture, as you say, and the costs that this imposes on him in terms of his life, right? It's not just making travel difficult. It is, as you say, now everyone knows he's there, knows he's a target. He's going to have to pay protection money. He's going to have to take a bunch of precautions that will.
And he can't just leave to avoid paying the protection money. Yes. Like it's not a good time, you know.
No, exactly. And like, that's good, right? Seeing some real cost imposed on people who have felt like they can just get away with this stuff and bribe their way out of whatever trouble, like limited trouble you might get to in Moscow or wherever, you know, they happen to be. So, yeah, I'm all for this. This is solid work by the Australian hounds. And, we salute you, sirs.
Yeah, I mean, we have seen a similar action. I was talking about this with our colleague, Tom Uren, yesterday, and I was like, I can't think of this anything quite like this happening before. And we went away and we did a bit of Googling, and Tom found and, you know, remembered that the US has previously sanctioned the group behind TrickBot, so the individuals attached to TrickBot. So we have seen these sort of sanctions before. I think this one still feels a bit different, though, because that was like, okay, we're sanctioning the members of a transnational sort of, you know, serious criminal organization. This one is like, we're sanctioning and identifying this guy because we don't like him.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it feels more personal than, because like he was associated with Revol, yeah, right? So they could have just said, we're going to sanction some Revol people. But yeah, this feels a bit more on the nose. And as you say, the fact that they are demonstrably up in his business.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder what else they've done to him. Right? Because they haven't said, like, I mean, they were clearly on his devices. And I just love it that someone made the decision to declass that photo they took of him through his own webcam. That's brilliant.
Yes.
Because that sends a message. But you wonder, like, was he using cold wallets? Was he diligent in his OPSEC? Does he still have his Bitcoin? Because if he's put in a position where he's identified as someone with a lot of Bitcoin who actually no longer has Bitcoin, you're thinking he's going to lose a few fingers. Anyway, my point is, I love this. I think it's great.
Yes.
Moving on to some actual law enforcement action on this. I got a release in front of me from the Department of Justice in the United States that a Palm Coast man has been arrested for wire fraud and aggravated identity theft charges. This is in Jacksonville, Florida. United States Attorney Roger B. Handberg announces the return of an indictment charging Noah Michael Urban, age 19, from Palm Coast, also known as Sosa, which I think is a terrific handle, by the way, because Sosa was the Colombian drug dealer in Scarface. But anyway, other handles, Elijah, King Bob, and Anthony Ramirez. He's been charged with one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud, eight counts of wire fraud, and five counts of aggravated identity theft. And he's looking at a number of years in prison. Now you're like, okay, why is Pat talking about some random 19-year-old in Florida getting arrested? It's because a little birdie got in my ear and told me this is one of the scattered spider kids.
Yeah, well, he's certainly a kid at 19, and they said something like $800,000 being stolen as part of the identity theft stuff he was involved in. So yeah, if he is one of the scattered spider crew, then, you know, clearly he's not going to be the first one, because I mean, that, you know, if they're up in that group and they're investigating and they're at the point
I think you mean he's not going to be the last one, but
not going to be the last one. Sorry. Then yeah, if they're up in those kids' business, then maybe this is the beginning of a bunch of them seeing some charges, which are probably well deserved.
Yeah. So this release actually went out on January 11, and no one kind of noticed. And then I got a sort of bit of a tip saying, it could be wrong, right? Mm-hmm. I've had bad information before, but I'm sort of told that this guy is allegedly involved in the scattered spider stuff. So yeah, bad time for him. It surprises me that it's taken as long as it did. I mean, it's still only been a few months though, really, hasn't it? So
yeah, and then these things do take time, and especially if it's a very big group with lots of connections, they got to unravel and decide that they've, you know, got everything they need to start, you know, making a, you know, actually rolling on them in public, see, having, you know, the news go out and stuff. So yeah, I'm sure a lot of solid police work was done.
Now, quick follow-up on the SEC Twitter hack. I just think it's interesting, actually, what happened here. They were having trouble with their MFA, so they asked Twitter support to disable it, and then they just never re-enabled it. And that's how someone was able to do a SIM swap. And, you know, so even if they were using SMS MFA at that point, it wouldn't have mattered because they SIM swapped it and took over the account that way. I did find something interesting, though, buried in this, which I didn't see previously. Like last week, we spoke about how I was crushed because it looked like they just published a draft tweet. On January 10, they actually said that the unauthorized content on the SEC Gov account was not drafted or created by the SEC. So that's interesting. So I was thinking they just pushed a draft tweet, but it actually looks like maybe they're about to pick up another star, Adam, for the Yelp for crime. Maybe it was actually cool.
Maybe they did Photoshop up the image that they posted it with to make it look like it was legit. But yeah, we'll see whether. I mean, still, what did you give it? Like 1.5 stars last week. So
I can't remember. I think it was still 2.5. But it might actually be what we thought it was, like, which is someone, and maybe even better, because they were drafting. You know, they did a tweet and, you know, legit looking artwork announcing something that the SEC was expected to announce anyway. So maybe they were like really playing 4D chess and they're back up to 5 stars. Maybe they can be 6 out of 5 stars.
Maybe. I guess we see whether Lamborghini sales peak in the United States next, or, you know, whether someone shows up with a whole bunch of money they may have, because that's the proof of the pudding, right? Because get rich. Don't try.
Let's see. Let's see. Let's see if there's an arrest in 6 months of someone for, you know, using Bitcoin instruments to trade on that. That'd be interesting. But I have a feeling this will just go away.
Probably.
That is my vibe on this. Now, let's talk about Pompom Purin. Because, you know, this is the owner of Breached Forums, just a kid who, like, yeah, looks like had a real hard time when being locked up. There's talk of, like, a suicide attempt, unfortunately. Unsuccessful, fortunately. Been sentenced to time served. This is Brian Connor Fitzpatrick, has been sentenced to time served and is just going to be on supervised release for checks notes basically forever. And no one's really quite clear on why, because the prosecution were asking for quite a heavy sentence here. And it looks like, yeah, that's not going to happen. And, you know, you wonder, you know, he had a sort of history of mental health issues, really not coping in prison. But, I mean, that's not usually a way that people wind up with a reduced sentence, is that they don't like prison and it is exacerbating their mental health condition. But I believe, you know, it's possible he's quite sick. And the other possibility, of course, is that, you know, there's maybe a cooperation agreement we're not aware of.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting because, you know, we're used to seeing disproportionate sentences in the United States towards the heavy side, and it's unusual to see something, you know, lenient or something that's got, you know, has taken into account some of those mitigating factors perhaps. So he was out on bail. Whilst he was going through the process of his trial, he got briefly rearrested for violating the bail conditions. And then, yeah, now is on home arrest for 2 years with a GPS, you know, location monitoring bracelet or whatever. And the terms of his, you know, supervised release are pretty strict. And some of them are like, you know, must not use the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's on an ankle monitor for the first 2 years.
For the first couple of years. Yeah. But then, you know, even after that, there is still a requirement that he's not allowed to have a job that involves the internet, which... like, who doesn't have email at work, right? I mean, that's a pretty difficult set of restrictions. There's also relating to the child sex abuse material that he had. There's a bunch of restraints about, you know, associating with children or being involved in jobs to have children and so on and so forth. So it's a pretty restrictive set of conditions, as you say, for 20 years.
Yeah.
And he can be thrown back in the clink, you know, if he violates those conditions. So it's, yeah, it's not a... you know, gentle slap on the wrist and off you go, enjoy the rest of your life.
No, it's onerous, yes. Supervised release, yeah. What's funny though, what you mentioned just about the not being allowed to use a computer thing, I just always remember the talk by Sammy Kamkar, who of course wrote the MySpace Sammy Worm, which took down MySpace quite by accident. So he got in a bunch of trouble over that. And as a part of, like, when he was going through the whole legal process on that, he was banned from using the internet for a couple of years. And what's funny is, like, if you've ever met Sammy, he's really charming. He's just a really agreeable guy to be around. He's a lot of fun. And, you know, he says he had to learn how to be agreeable and fun to be around because he wasn't allowed on the internet anymore. It made him go out and develop social skills, which he said he absolutely did not have before that period where he got kicked off the internet. So there you go.
He had so many friends on MySpace.
Yeah, all of them. that was kind of the problem. Now, CISA has issued an emergency directive for federal agencies to apply mitigations for this Ivanti stuff. There's a, you know, crew going around exploiting Ivanti software, and the mitigation, I believe you've looked at that, it's pretty ugly. I mean, I know Graynoise is seeing this popping off, right? So it's like they're the disaster child this week, Ivanti, and even Moody's has, like, downrated them in terms of credit because of, you know, what's happening. So yeah, Ivanti is this week's disaster vendor.
Yeah, they certainly are. I mean, that mitigation that you're supposed to roll out looked unpleasant as an admin and, you know, apropos of our various conversations about how difficult it is to patch fast enough these days. Now we've got CISA telling people you need to download this weird XML file from Ivanti and apply it to your things because there still isn't a patch yet. I think Velexity, who had been tracking compromise of this, said there's currently at least 2,100 systems that are already compromised. So if you have one of these and you're getting CISA's guidance now, you know, you probably should be running the integrity checking tool. Although I think even that they were starting to bypass as well, the attackers who were doing this. So, you know, that conversation we had about, it was on Seriously Risky Business about how China is willing to, dig in ways that, you know, Western intelligence or Western cyber, you know, actors probably wouldn't. Yeah, they are bypassing the tools that that Avanti are working on. So, like, it's just such a mess. So don't blame Moody's for, you know, downgrading the outlook on them.
Yeah, so Moody's Investor Service said that the attacks are credit negative against Avanti. The attacks have a negative implication for the company's reputation and could lead to higher customer attrition, potential litigation, and impact revenue growth. Cybersecurity Dive has that report. But, Adam, Moody's might be wrong.
They may well be.
Depressingly, this is this story. There's always one every week that makes you want to go live in a log cabin and just never connect to the internet again. And the what are we all doing here story. And this is another one from Cybersecurity Dive. Matt Capco has this one. And it's that MoveIt, Progress Software, the company that owns MoveIt, and we all know MoveIt was the disastrous file transfer appliance that got everybody owned. Was that last year? Yeah. Business is great. Business is booming. MoveIt is one of their stronger performing lines to the moon. So that's what making terrible products that get all your customers owned gets you is
13% year-on-year revenue growth.
13% year-on-year growth in revenue. What I mean, you know.
And the file transfer component, 17% year-on-year growth. So
to the moon.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Moody's may be wrong. Maybe Avanti is also going to go to the moon, and now is your chance to buy low and sell high. But yeah,
this people heard of MoveIt, didn't they? Through all of that,
I guess. Like any publicity is good publicity, they say, right? And I wish that wasn't true because it really shouldn't be. But perhaps, you know, perhaps us and our dear listeners are, you know, just crying to themselves all day long, and no one else really cares about the cybers and about the computers and the securities and all of the data and all the people who have their things stolen. It's depressing, isn't it?
We just weep salty tears of defeat.
We do.
Now, we've got a few more stories to get through before we bring on this week's feature guest, but we'll just run through these quickly. The Record is reporting that Kyivstar, which was attacked by the Sandworm crew and, you know, they had their whole infrastructure RMRF'd, that's going to cost them $100 million in foregone revenue because they're doing this big customer loyalty push. Because obviously the first thing that happened when they went down is a whole bunch of people went out and bought SIMs for rival networks. And, you know, so they're trying to rebalance all of that. So it looks like the cost is going to be at least $100 million just on that side of things. There's a link in this week's show notes to the write-up from Darina Antonik, who is, of course, based in Kyiv. We've got another one from The Record here by Alexander Martin that is worth drawing attention to. Which says ransomware attacks leave small business owners feeling suicidal. And this is a report from RUSI, which is the Royal United Services Institute. And it's just important work that I think needs to be highlighted. And I've dropped a link into this week's show notes to that one. But I just want to read a couple of paragraphs from it. RUSI assessed that incidents affecting small business owners can have a greater psychological impact because of how close together the individual's personal and private lives can feel. And here's a quote: if you run your own business for 20 years, that is your personality. That is your only source of income. I feel that, you know, I've run this business nearly 20 years. It's a big part of my identity. I feel it. So when I was reading this, I was just thinking, you know, what if I wasn't a, you know, security person and I'd built, you know, some business in some other industry, then someone just came along and torched it. You know, what would that do to me? And it wouldn't be pretty. Did you find this one a harrowing read as well?
Yeah, it really is, you know, and we are fortunate that we're in an industry that kind of allows us to protect ourselves to a degree, but you really feel it for so many. I think of, you know, so many customers that I've dealt with over my years in consultancy, you know, who just aren't equipped to deal with these threats. And yeah, you see them having their stuff torched, stuff that they've worked on for years, and having to make choices to, you know, let some of their staff go because businesses, you know, their business has been disrupted or whatever else. Like, you really do, you know, has very, very real impacts of stuff. And it's hard to read.
Yeah. And we're just going to finish up here with a story from Brian Krebs. And this one is just, what is this? Like, basically a Canadian man just tried to buy something on Amazon and he wound up being arrested.
Yes. So this was, he fell victim to a scam where someone lists on an online marketplace like an Amazon or eBay or whatever else the products for sale. You buy them. then they use a stolen credit card to buy the products that you have ordered and ship them to you from some other third party, you know.
Amazon, yeah, so they drop ship. Else. They basically drop ship to you using a stolen credit card.
Yes. And then in this particular case, the guy worked for like a First Nations group in Alberta that provided, like in this case, he was buying like multiple sets of children's outdoor like furniture or whatever, like things for kids to play on, and that he was going to distribute to the, you know, the youths in his neighborhood. And the person whose credit card was used phoned the Canadian Mounties. The Canadian Mounties rolled up to this guy's house and arrested him for using a stolen credit card to buy these goods. And now he ended up getting fired from his job because he got a, you know, got charged with a crime, even though, you know, the police in this case, I think, have chosen not to prosecute. Now they understand their mistake. But it's really ruined this guy's life. And he just went online and bought something from a seller that had 4.5 stars out of 5 or whatever from this Amazon Marketplace seller. And Amazon's like, well, which,
yep,
you know, not a great response. And, yeah, I mean, there's so many ways to do online fraud and online crime, but the ones that leave a really horrible trail behind them, like ruining people's lives, this is one of them. And it was just a horrible read. Normally the Krebs stories end with someone getting doxxed or outed or whatever else, and this one didn't have a happy ending. So, yeah, grim.
Grim indeed. Yeah, well, that's a bucket of sunshine to end the news on, mate. But that is the end of this week's news segment. And it's time to speak to our feature guest now, Rob Silvers. Rob is the Undersecretary for Policy at the US Department of Homeland Security, and he's also the chair of the Cyber Safety Review Board, or CSRB. Now, there was a Senate hearing into the CSRB last week, and it heard testimony from the likes of Tara Wheeler and Trey Herr from the Atlantic Council. And yeah, the witnesses agreed that CSRB should have more powers, which it is likely to get because there's a bill before Congress right now that would make the CSRB permanent and give it subpoena powers. And currently it's not permanent because it was established via an executive order signed by Joe Biden. But it wasn't all, you know, positive stuff last week at the Senate hearing. The witnesses also criticized CSRB for having industry board members, which, you know, okay, fine. There is potential for conflicts of interest there if you have industry participants. But that's not something that hasn't been addressed. And I think that's maybe something the witnesses there didn't necessarily know about. So we're going to get Rob's thoughts on that in a moment. But Rob, welcome. And first of all, why don't you just tell us a bit about what will change if this CSRB legislation actually passes and makes the board permanent?
Patrick, Adam, thanks a lot for having me on the program. So it's important to start with, right now, the Cyber Safety Review Board is fully operational and conducting its reviews. The board was actually launched by an order that President Biden issued in 2021, his landmark cybersecurity order. And we have conducted 2 complete reviews to date on the Log4j vulnerability and then on the Lapsus group of threat actors. And now we're in the middle of our third into the recent Microsoft Exchange Online intrusion that was reported in the summer of last year. What we've proposed as an administration is legislation that we want to work with our Congress on that would enshrine the board in law and give it some additional authorities to do its work while also maintaining its really unique character as a truly public-private organization where half the members are all the public sector U.S. government leads for cybersecurity and half the members are cybersecurity luminaries from industry and academia and the nonprofit world. The legislation would, amongst other changes, give to the board a limited subpoena authority to ensure that the board can get access to whatever information it needs to conduct its authoritative after-action reviews and develop those lessons learned from the biggest cybersecurity incidents that the cybersecurity community needs. And to
could you arrange this so that we can have subpoena authority as well when we're looking at a breach? Because that would be super, Rob.
CSRB first, and then risky business,
and then journalists. Yeah. Got it. Now, look, there was this. You spoke about the public-private dimension to this, and last week we did hear some Senate testimony where people were bringing up this idea that having industry involved introduces a bunch of conflicts of interest. And look, I can understand on the surface why people. Why that's something that needs to be considered, right? Because, people do have, the people who are contributing to the board, many of them are industry people who do have interests outside of government. But at the same time, I don't think the people doing the testimony maybe realize that the rules around this are actually quite strict already. Like, what are the rules in terms of deconflicting some of these investigations?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and we have really good answers to that question, because it's of utmost importance that the board's work be done free from any kind of preference or bias or favoritism on the part of any of the members. And I can understand why people ask the question, well, if you're going to have industry members on the board, aren't they going to make decisions that tilt in favor of whoever their employer is? But here's the thing, we have developed really stringent ethics and recusal rules for every aspect of the board's work. We have DHS career agency ethics lawyers who receive full financial disclosures from every single member. They know what they're invested in, who their employer is, where they draw income from, and they make assessments for each review as to any potential conflicts of interest. And if there is a conflict of interest, or even the appearance of a conflict of interest, then the Ethics Council will order that a member be recused from the review at issue. And we have exercised that recusals process successfully in our work. In the current review of the Microsoft Exchange Online incident, we have a small handful of members that are not participating in the review because of potential conflicts of interest. But we have 12 members that have been cleared by our agency ethics council and are proceeding with all the thorough and rigorous work that's needed here. So people can have confidence that we've thought through these issues, and there are really strong protections in place to protect against any potential conflicts of interest.
I mean, you've even had members who've sold shares, right, to avoid conflicts, like dumping Microsoft stock or whatever, because, they can't hold that if they want to participate in a review.
We have had members who have divested themselves of stock holdings because those stock holdings would have put them into a conflict.
Divested of themselves of stock holdings does sound better than dumped their shares. I will give you that, Rob.
But we have different jobs. But the thing is, these are important issues to be managed, but it's really important to keep in mind how unique and how empowering it is for the board's mission and work to have industry luminaries as core members of this operation.
Well, I was having this conversation with a friend the other day because, who was it? It was Tom Uren, our colleague, who writes Seriously Risky Biz. And I'm like, the thing about the industry people, the thing that they have that is hard to get from non-industry people is what I call sort of like ecosystem knowledge, right?
Yeah.
They've just got that broader view. So there's definitely potential for conflicts, but again, if you've got really robust procedures to handle that are adhered to, then you can mitigate the issues there, you would think.
Absolutely. And the private sector membership is part of what makes the board's work high quality, because you have that unique vantage point. We don't have a monopoly on the good ideas or experience in the government by any means. And it also is what gives the board a lot of credibility to drive change, right?
Yes, yeah, so it's not just some government person saying what you can and can't, what you should and shouldn't do. It's actually
exactly
coming from,
it's those government people.
Yeah.
But it's also some of the leading cybersecurity minds of our generation. And when those people come together and speak as to what needs to happen out there, what CISOs need to do, what network defenders need to do, what regulators need to do, what legislatures need to do, that speaks with incredible force and cannot be replicated by a government-only enterprise.
Yeah.
And so we have picked the right model here, and we put in place those safeguards to make sure that the model is free from those important risks of conflict of interest.
Seeing the output from the board, for me as a, you know, as a practitioner who's been in the industry for a very long time, knowing that people who I trust, you know, people like Heather Adkins, for example, who've just been around the block for so long and really understand it, just makes that output so much more valuable to me than, you know, another FBI jib or, you know, or something like that, that, you know, I don't necessarily understand the provenance of. And it's just really, you know, I think a super important part of the board's work.
Now, speaking of that output, right, there was one bit of weird criticism that popped up at the Senate hearing, which was, oh, you know, there's nothing really new in these reports. You know, they're issuing recommendations like use MFA and whatever. I don't know if they were reading the same reports because, you know, it's not just, you don't just get a CSRB report to read it for its recommendations. You know, the Lapsus report I loved, and it was funny because that one just copped so much flack. Like, people really criticized that report, but I thought it was just extraordinary because it foreshadowed what would later happen with this scattered spider group, right? It was just an exceptional report. And I at the time it was released, I described it as, you know, required reading for any CISOs out there. And I stand by that. I think still, if you haven't read it, you should go out and read it. But you did actually drive some change through that one as well with the, was it the FTC or the FCC? One of your other agencies actually took some action in the telco space to try to minimize SIM swapping.
That's exactly right. So what we found as we were reviewing Lapsus, and what was amazing about Lapsus is that it was a bunch of members, many of whom were teenagers, who were consistently, week after week, able to break into the best defended companies in the world, the most richly resourced companies in the world. And what that told us is, there's something that needs to be looked into here. If these kinds of sort of amateur, if you will, threat actors are able to consistently break into the crown jewels of really sophisticated organizations. One of the things we found, to your point, Patrick, was that they were using SIM swapping to as the threat, as the attack vector in a number of their hits, and they were essentially using that to gain access to broader corporate environments. And what we did in our recommendations was we said that the Federal Communications Commission, which is our telecoms regulator here in the United States, really needs to increase its oversight and regulation of the mobile phone providers to protect their users against SIM swapping, because it can be, SIM swapping is comparatively rare, but it is devastating impact on the victim. It can really overturn your life. And the FCC, and then we worked afterwards with the FCC to explain our findings. It was a really good relationship. And then the FCC, which is an independent regulator that makes its own decisions about what to do, decided and recently issued new enforcement guidelines to require enhanced security protections to telecoms providers to protect against SIM swapping. And the chairwoman of the FCC, Jessica Rosenworcel, specifically called out the Cyber Safety Review Board for recommending that course of action. And so this is exactly the kind of impact that this body was designed to have. And it's exactly the kind of impact that we are having.
And okay, so here's the part that makes me feel like I'm taking crazy pills, because I was in the United States, you know, a few months ago, and in DC, right? And something I consistently heard, mostly from like journalists and stuff, is like, well, why didn't they investigate SolarWinds, right? So this is the common thing. It's been a running theme for like a couple of years. Why won't they investigate SolarWinds? Like, it's some sort of cover-up. I mean, in my view, I don't know really much else what we would learn from that, considering that, you know, there's a full Mandiant report and it's a pretty well-understood incident. And it's also quite old now. But like, how do you actually pick what it is that you're going to look at? Because, you know, is it a shadowy cabal of people trying to cover up SolarWinds, or is it something, I'm guessing it's something a little bit more boring. Rob, can you please tell us what it is?
So the Secretary of Homeland Security and the Director of CISA have the authority to task the board with what it should look at. And when we're having those discussions about what the taskings should be, it's always a discussion around What should we give the board that will really, on the other end of the review, drive change in the community? Where can we reach impact? Where are there lessons learned that are as yet undiscovered or underdiscovered, and that haven't been deeply studied, where there hasn't already been a lot of analysis done of the incident or the issue, and where the CSRB's unique voice can drive better security? With Log4j, you had this endemic vulnerability that was the worst software vulnerability of all time. You had an all-community incident response all at the same time. Incredibly unique insights gained into the open source security community and vulnerabilities there.
If you want to understand supply chain risk, that's the one you look at, right?
Like, exactly right. Yeah. So really important. Lapsus, likewise, right? I mean, you said it. It was not a household name, and yet we saw in it a lot of risk to the community and something that could metastasize, because those TTPs can be used against anyone and by anyone. They're not that sophisticated, actually. And so we were like, we need to put out a playbook so that network defenders know what to do to protect themselves against that. And then sure enough, we published, and very shortly thereafter, you see Scattered Spider come out on all the same Telegram channels, using all the same techniques and processes to do it. And it's like, it is the playbook.
It was amazing, amazing vindication for the decision, I thought.
Totally. And then, you know, with SolarWinds, listen, that was a very serious incident that had a lot of impact and drove a lot of change within the community. By the time the Cyber Safety Review Board was operational and the members had been onboarded, that incident had actually been very well studied. And the U.S. government had taken on a lot of lessons learned and specific lines of action to address deficiencies that came out through the study of SolarWinds. So, for example, everyone on a bipartisan basis circled around the need for incident reporting rules. And Congress passed a law to give CISA that. That was a direct result of SolarWinds. We mandated through executive orders, zero trust architecture in our vendors, all kinds of supply chain security efforts that the U.S. government would be leading, all because of SolarWinds. It was, when you put that up against the other less discovered pieces of the ecosystem and things that had happened, we all felt that the real impact would be driven by looking at other fresher incidents.
And look, my final question, it is a slightly curly one, sorry about that, but you know, there's been a question raised, and I think it's a reasonable question actually, about whether or not the CSRB having subpoena powers might kind of put it into a position where, you know, it turns DHS into a bit of an adversary, and obviously CISA sits under DHS. You know, could this, you know, throw some sand in the gears at CISA, you know, if a DHS, you know, investigations agency is given subpoena powers?
No, I don't think so. I think everybody understands CISA's business model for working day in, day out with companies on their incident response, on sharing and pushing best practices. The CSRB is a unit that is administered by CISA but operates independently. And at the end of the day, people understand that if you want to know what happened in this world, then you need to give those who are tasked with looking into it the ability to get the information. And I don't think it's going to disrupt the relations at all. I will just say, though, because I do think there's some misunderstanding, I have heard criticisms that our draft legislation would give private sector members the ability to issue a subpoena against their competitor. And that's really actually not the case. The legislation that we have proposed specifically says that only federal members, the government members, can vote on issuance of a subpoena. We just felt like that's an inherently governmental power.
Yes.
That shouldn't be shared with private sector members. And in any event, private sector members, if their competitor is involved, they're going to be recused off anything having to do with their competitor anyway.
Well, and the nice thing about having subpoena powers is once you have the powers, you generally don't need to use them because people know that you can subpoena them.
If you look at the National Transportation Safety Board, which in the U.S. system is the agency that investigates air crashes and the like, they have subpoena authority, but they almost never use it because the companies that they work with and fact gather from understand that it's there and they'd prefer not to get one.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, yeah, it's a power that you have, so you don't need to use it, which is always a funny one. All right, Rob Silvers, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to wrap it up there. A great chat about all things CSRB. Really enjoying the report so far, and I'm really looking forward to the next one on the Microsoft. And, you know, I genuinely am looking forward to that one because it's going to tell us really what happened with that Microsoft Exchange Online hack. Yeah, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Patrick. Thanks, Adam.
That was Adam Boileau with the news there, and Rob Silvers jumping in as this week's feature guest. Big thanks to both of them for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Travis McPeak, the founder and CEO of Resourcely. And Resourcely is a pretty simple play, really. It helps you manage your Terraform. So if you've got like 1,000 different Terraform modules and they're all unique little snowflakes and the whole thing is just a complete mess, you know, you'd probably do well to contact Resourcely. It'll help you provision resources through Terraform in a not insane way. But Travis is joining us this week to talk about how we need this kind of approach across the board, not just when it comes to Terraform. You know, a very typical sales call for Travis is like when someone's become a customer of one of the CSPM products like Wiz, and they just wind up choking on its output. So they ring him and they say, please help. But the bigger point here is that surely we should be trying to stop the problems being created before they wind up in a dashboard, right? And not just Terraform. Terraform provisioning should be easy. So should encryption. So should authentication. So should logging. So many of these things should just be easier. So here's Travis now to kick things off in this interview by recapping the sales call he had just like a moment before I spoke to him.
So we got a POV going with a very large company. They had recently brought in one of the leading CSPMs, and they found out very quickly that they had thousands of issues overflowing at a much faster rate than they can actually address those issues. And then they got interested in potentially doing something proactive to prevent this pain from happening in the future, or at least continuing to accumulate.
Well, I mean, this is the issue, right? With CSPM and dashboards and whatnot, they're really great at surfacing problems, but you quickly get into a point where you can't just take the outputs for these things and generate tickets because you're going to drown everyone in tickets.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And if you think about it, there's a disconnect between the people filing the tickets and then who needs to take action for it. You know, they're not all on the same page. Sometimes they don't have the right context, but really it's a big pile of work for somebody to go take on. And that work doesn't end up being high priority often. So we end up in this kind of phase where security's nagging you to go fix your tickets, please. These things don't get fixed. 60% of breaches involve known issues. So that's a whole cycle of pain that we'd like to improve.
Yeah, so there's a lot of companies out there now who are going through these processes of using the scanning tools, the posture management tools, and you know all sorts of tools like things that interrogate APIs and whatnot to surface issues and realizing that they can't ticket their way out of it. So they're moving to an approach of trying to stop these things from becoming issues in the first place. I mean, this is what Resourcely does. It tackles, you know, certainly doesn't tackle this whole problem, but that's going to be the topic of this conversation. The stuff that you tackle specifically is, you know, Terraform issues, Terraform misconfigurations and whatnot. You just give people an easy way to provision that stuff so that it doesn't turn into a mess in the first place. I mean, that's, you know, the simplest description for Resourcely, that would be it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, our goal is to give that context to a developer or whoever else needs something in line and tell them, not you did this wrong, you need to go fix this, especially not late, but at the time that they actually want to get something set up, to help make it dead simple for them to know, what is that thing I should pick? How do I actually set this up well?
Yeah. Now, as I just mentioned, you know, this problem is a lot bigger than just the part that you're solving, right? So I thought it'd be a good idea to talk to you because you've got a long background in doing stuff in these sort of, you know, I mean, you can't really call DevOps modern anymore, but in these sort of DevOps environments, right? And I remember I had you on the show many years ago talking about RepoKid, which was a tool that you wrote when you worked at Netflix, which would go and nuke unused unused permissions from and privileges from accounts across different services. That was that was really cool. But yeah, now you're moving on to this idea of paved roads, right? So like, how do you help a developer? You know, because a developer doesn't want to deal with a lot of this stuff, right? They just want to get their code up and running in an environment that's going to work and get stuff done for them. So you've tackled the Terraform bit of that. But there's a whole bunch of other areas that are ripe for a similar approach, which frankly, I mean, you're not going to go there, but there are these other areas. Like, why don't we talk about some of them? I mean, one that you mentioned to me that's really straightforward is just encryption. You know, like having to put encryption in place in these web applications and whatnot can be really fiddly and put people in a situation where months down the track there's broken certificates everywhere and people can't manage it. So, I mean, this is just one example, one other example of where people could probably make some gains, right?
Yeah, and the really cool thing about this is, you know, traditionally in an infra team, security, you know, DevOps, it's kind of an adversarial situation, right? It's zero sum. Developers lose, security wins, developers, you know, whatever. Like, it's all mixed up. Somebody's going to be coming away unhappy. With a paved road, you can actually create this win-win condition where security gets everything set up from the get-go correctly. That means they don't have to fix it later. And developers get a simple path to get whatever they need. So yeah, we call these paved roads at Netflix. I would actually call the RepoKid project a paved road for least privilege. Now developers don't need to do anything. They just get roles that are exactly what they need, completely zero touch for them. So that's a win. Crypto's a easy one, right? Because that's scary. Like, even as a security person, I don't want to go figure out crypto. It's complex. There's a lot of knobs. I might screw it up and cause a really bad day for the company. So I think making it easy to manage keys, making it easy to get certificates. You know, we had a project at Netflix called Lemur that did exactly that. So now developers, when they want a certificate for their app, they don't have to worry about picking parameters and managing private keys and rotating. That's a whole class of easy win. A bunch of this simple web application stuff, right? This is why we have frameworks. So this is our standard logging format. This is how we want to do auth. This is our AuthZ integration.
Well, all of this. Hang on. Let's talk about those two individually, because like, they're both big. I mean, auth is huge. Thankfully, we've got some vendors in that space who are doing some pretty sensible stuff. Like, you know, AuthZero is terrific, then acquired by Okta. And I believe like some recent price hikes have sort of upset people, but certainly that is something that you can buy. Logging is an interesting one though, right? Because yeah, there's only a few people doing it now. A lot of people claim to be able to help you with just being able to import logs and get logs flowing from web applications. But that is way harder than it should be, right? Like, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's way harder than it should be. So if you want to implement some kind of a standard in the organization, you know, this is the kind of events that we gather. This is the level of detail we put into them. You know, that's cognitive load on developers. I think that's the main theme, right? Cognitive load, just number of things that developers need to understand how to do correctly. So there's all of that part of it. And then there's the collection of them. How do we go and take these logs and put them in a central location where they're automatically backed up and rotated and retained for the right period of time? So developers shouldn't have to worry about any of that stuff either. There's tons of more complexity that spins off from there, right? Like, the idea is like, developers can just import a thing and then they pick what's relevant for their application and things just get set up in the correct format.
Yeah, I mean, I know Panther is a company that we've had some dealings with here. They're a Seam company, and you know, one thing that they love to talk about is how that they can help you actually get logs out of web apps into a Seam, you know, which is just kind of crazy that there's a market need for that. You would think that we should have, you know, like so much of this stuff, you would think that it always should have been that way, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, even developers shouldn't really have to understand. I mean, there's a ton of best practices about what kind of logs you should emit and the level of detail in them, and getting every developer to be experts in logging configuration really doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Just on the auth stuff though, I'm curious like how people are handling that one. Cause I imagine a lot of people would have been using like third party vendors for that. Is that still the case, or are people starting to, or are there like new crops of vendors coming up who are doing it in different ways, or like where is that all at the moment?
Well, what we had at Netflix, which was really nice, is developers didn't have to worry about it. So we had basically an identity aware proxy that we offered, and security as well as, you know, reliability and other folks would put things into that proxy. So now if you integrate the proxy, there's a simple way to do SSO. there's a simple framework you can use to define, you know, users and groups and who has access to what in your application. There was a WAF bundled into it, so it was resilient against attacks. You know, load balancing, all of that was in there. So that was kind of like a one-touch. Developers don't need to worry about any of this stuff. I think in the vendor landscape, we see much more fragmented. So, you know, as you mentioned, we have tools like Auth0 that are great for not having to roll your own Auth0. And then we have a different set of tools that handle the authentication part in SSO.
Yeah, and the proxying stuff, right? Like that's different again. Yeah.
Yep.
Whereas
yep.
with stuff like Auth0, it's very much about building, you know, using their tools in your web applications.
Right. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a kind of a rebundling of these things as well. It would be nice to just have a kind of integrated. There might already be a vendor solution that handles everything that the web app developer needs to worry about aside from the business logic of their application.
Now, we've just spoken about a few examples here, right? Authentication, encryption, and the infrastructure side, which is what you do. You know, it feels like this is the cynic in me coming out. It sort of feels like wishful thinking that we're going to get to this point anytime soon where these are things developers don't need to think about. But that is the ultimate goal, isn't it?
That's the ultimate goal. If you don't do that, so we do what we do today, right? There's things that tell you about problems after they already exist. You're going to face a lot of pain. It's just a different kind of pain, right? It's never-ending tickets. It's developers being forced to upend whatever their plan work was to go and fix stuff. This is like trope at this point, but anytime you catch stuff late, it's way more expensive for everybody involved to go and address it. I mean, at the same time, we see tons of companies where there's whole organizations of teams that do nothing but help developers provision and manage stuff. So this is definitely like pain that's being borne out. We've kind of half DevOpsed ourselves into this.
Well, it's funny because we always talk about shift left, right? In terms of making sure that code quality is good, but it feels like we haven't put the same emphasis on all of the support, on the infrastructure bit, right? On the ops bit. It's all been about shifting left in the code.
Right. And a lot of times when we say shift left, we're talking about pipeline, really. So, you know, before it gets deployed, we're going to do some kind of analysis and tell you about potential problems that exist. One of the problems that we've seen with that is they don't really have context, right? If you're finding out about something in pipeline, you have no developer intent. If you actually shift that left to the actual developer, they know what they're trying to get done. You can ask them some questions about that and then make the right policy and configuration answers based on whatever they're telling you.
All right. Well, Travis McPeak, thank you very much for joining us for this interview. Again, if you are struggling with Terraform, if you've got Terraform modules that are all unique and numerous and you realize you cannot continue this way, definitely hit up Resourcely, Travis McPeak's company. Thank you very much for joining us and thanks for sponsoring this week's episode of the show. Cheers.
Thanks for having me.
That was Travis McPeak of Resourcely there, and you can find them at resourcely.io. So that is resourcely.io. And if you have a Terraform problem, if you have Terraform issues, if your Terraform use is heavy, then give him a call. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back next week. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.